It's April 9th, 1993, at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. 11,000 people, grunge kids, jocks, metalheads, mainstreamers, punks, little kids with their parents, hippie types, have come from as far away as Los Angeles and Seattle to see Nirvana's first American show in 7 months, a benefit for Bosnian rape victims. Besides a 7-week club tour in late 1991, the closest most American fans had come to seeing the band in concert was their appearance on Saturday Night Live over a year before. So much has happened in the meantime. Drug rumors, breakup rumors, lawsuits, and about 5 million more copies of the Nevermind album sold worldwide. And much hasn't happened. A U.S. arena tour, a new album. It's a crucial show. The band walks out on stage, Kurt Cobain sporting an aqua cardigan, an inside-out Captain America t-shirt, and decomposing blue jeans gives a nervous little wave to the crowd. He's dyed his hair blonde for the occasion. A mop of it obscures his eyes and, indeed, the entire top half of his face. From the opening chords of Rape Me, the band plays with explosive force, salvos of sound catapulting off the stage and into the crowd. Breed, Blue, Sliver, Milk It, Heart-Shaped Box. Toward the end, they play The Hit, and even though Kurt mangles the opening chords, the moshers on the floor go berserk. As matches and lighters are held aloft during Lithium, everyone in this cavernous barn is reminded of exactly why they love Nirvana. Although Chris Novoselic and Kurt are at least 30 feet apart, they move and react to each other as if they're much closer. The communication is effortless. Midway through the set, Kurt calls over to Chris, "I feel great. I could play another hour." And they do, packing 24 songs in an hour and a half, including 8 songs from the upcoming album. The crowd applauds the new stuff enthusiastically, especially the ferocious assault on Scentless Apprentice and the majestic All Apologies, which dissolves in a haze of mantra chant and feedback. Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam watches from the side of the stage. Not far away is the Melvins' Dale Crover. Frances Bean Cobain is upstairs in her dad's dressing room with her nanny. Courtney comes down just in time to dodge a plastic bottle of mineral water that Kurt has thrown without looking. She waves at him sarcastically. At the end of the set, Kurt, Chris, and Dave Grohl disappear behind the drum riser and pass around a cigarette as they discuss what songs to play, then return for a 7-song, half-hour encore climaxing with Endless Nameless, the mystery track that closes Nevermind. As the band accelerates the song's main riff, it becomes a trance. Kurt walks across the top of his amp stack. It's not that high off the ground, but he's riveting anyway, like a potential suicide walking along the ledge of a building. The music speeds up even more. The guitars are squalling, Chris has unstrapped his bass and is waving it in front of his amp. Dave Grohl flails with precise abandon. As the music peaks, Kurt falls hard onto the drum set, and drums and cymbal stands fall outward like a carnivorous flower opening up and swallowing its prey. Show over. People ask each other if he's all right. It's not showmanship. If it were, they'd put down padding first. Maybe it's a geek stunt, like the kid in grade school who would make his nose bleed and smear the blood on his face so the bully would leave him alone. A case of I'll hurt myself before you can, from a guy who opened the set with a song called Rape Me. Perhaps it's an homage to two of Kurt's favorite stuntmen, Evel Knievel and Iggy Pop. Or is it that he's so jazzed up from the music that he's impervious to all physical harm, like a psyched-up swami who can walk across hot coals? Judging by the audience, all agog and aglow, that last explanation seems to fit the best. Afterward, the entire entourage celebrates the triumphant gig in the courtyard of the trendy Phoenix Motel, except for Kurt and Courtney, who have retired to a fancy hotel across town. The Phoenix, Courtney says, holds some bad memories for them, and besides, the bath towels are too small. Even without them, the place has turned into a little Nirvana village. Dave and his mother and sister are there. Chris and Shelley are there. So is smiling Ernie Bailey, the guitar tech, and his wife Brenda, tour manager Alex McLeod, lighting designer Suzanne Sasek, folks from Gold Mountain Management, Mark Cates from Geffen DGC, even members of Seattle's Love Battery who happen to be in town. Chris goes down to the grocery store and gets a couple armloads of beer, and the party lasts into the wee hours of the morning. The next day, Chris makes a pilgrimage to the fabled Beat Landmark, the City Lights bookstore. He goes outside to a cash machine where a homeless man announces, "Good news, people. We are pleased to accept $20 bills for Easter." Chris gives him one. The Cow Palace show was a victory. It seemed like a confirmation that a punk rock band that hit the mainstream jackpot wasn't a fluke after all. That victory had repercussions for the band, all the bands like them, and maybe even the culture at large. As Sonic Youth's Kim Gordon said recently, when a band like Nirvana comes out of the underground, it really expresses something that's going on in the culture, and it's not a commodity. What was going on in the culture was reflected not only in the sound of the music, but just as importantly, how it became popular. The punk rock phenomenon started practically the moment Johnny Ramone first put pick to string, inspiring a decade and a half's worth of hard work by countless bands, independent record labels, radio stations, magazines and fanzines, and small record stores that struggled to create some sort of alternative to the bland, condescending corporate rock which is being foisted on the public by the cynical major labels, the impersonal arenas, the mega-sized record stores, the lowest common denominator radio stations, and the star-struck national rock magazines.